Three, two, one. Hello and welcome to the Village Celebration Podcast. Another police shooting, another hashtag. Terrence Crutcher. Video shows Crutcher's SUV stalled in the middle of a highway. He walks toward it with his hands in the air, and suddenly he falls to the ground, shot dead by Officer Betty Shelby. We've all seen the video. Meanwhile, in Charlotte, North Carolina, a man shot and killed by police. Police say Keith Scott had a gun. Family members say he had a book. Protesters have rallied in Charlotte and all around America. We are asking ourselves, when will this end? When did the police start killing African Americans and getting away with it? The consensus of many is that this is nothing new. Joining us with a historical perspective on the police and the Black community is sociologist Veronica Newton. Veronica, thank you for joining us.
Yes, no problem. Glad to be here.
Let's talk about the police and the African American community. There's so much distrust at this point. I think a lot of us are asking, when did this start?
Right. So there's so many questions so many things and issues, right, that are constantly coming up with these police killings. And so from a historical perspective, which is I always like to take when looking at social issues such as police brutality, right, we have to go back to the origins. We cannot forget the historical context in which all these situations are set in. So when we think about the development of police departments, the police departments really did not come to be until post-emancipation. Policing in the North and in the South were very different. So in the North, where there really wasn't much slavery happening, right? It wasn't the typical antebellum Southern plantation style of slavery. So in the North, there would have different sheriffs, small units of policing. There'd be community members that would help police just certain crimes, small infractions, right? However, in the South was a completely different story. There weren't police officers. There may have been a sheriff for a town here and there to, like I mentioned, to help diffuse certain small situations. But policing as we know it started with slave hunters. And slave hunters were the people who were hired by slave-holding white men to capture or to recapture or to catch slaves who attempted to run away, right? This was their actual term. They were slave hunters. They had a badge, and they had guns, and they had weapons, as well as bloodhounds to chase and seek after enslaved blacks who attempted to escape to the North for freedom. This is important because this idea of having authority and having a badge and having social control over black individuals stems from plantation owners and slave hunters, right?
So let me just ask you right there, this idea of a license to do as one pleases dates back many, many, many years, because that's what we hear a lot and that's what we're seeing in these videos. It seems as if the police feel they can do as they please.
Yes, it's that discretion, right? It's that discretion to control certain bodies, right? And those bodies have always been black bodies. There's always been a structural control for a social control to control black bodies moving throughout the spaces within the United States. And so the slave hunters had all discretion, had all the power, and would have networks, right, into being able to try to catch or recapture blacks. Even when blacks did travel and make it to the North, there was still that social capital, there was still that social connection that slave hunters had with different officers and other, you know, white individuals, white male individuals in particular at that time, to whether it was write letters to say, well, there's someone who looks like that, maybe you're enslaved black, so I'm going to have them transport it back to you, right? So there's always a conjunction and a connection between the different states, right, which is why we see police brutality popping up across the nation, right? It's not like it's just in one isolated city, right? It's not like it's just Ferguson, Missouri. It's in every city. It's in Baltimore. It's in North Carolina. It's in California, right? And so that police culture has transgressed just not just from being in the South, but also being in the North. And that really happened post-emancipation when we have the great migration of blacks moving to northern cities, right? We also had an influx of European immigrants coming in, and there was more crime rates happening because of lack of housing and lack of resources, right? And mm-hmm. so people were blaming these new people in these new northern cities with, you know, they're blaming crime on them, right? And so these police strategies that were utilized within the South to help control blacks and to control where they lived, control what they did, who they hung out with, were utilized within the police forces, right? So this is when we see a development of police departments utilizing these same social control tactics that were utilized by slave hunters during the antebellum South.
So it's almost as if this police culture that we see today is a part of the DNA of the authority structure that's used to police, as you're saying, black bodies. So it's only morphed a little bit. It's adjusted to the times.
Right, because when we think about the transition of race as a social concept, right, it's not really acceptable for institutions and just Americans in general. We'll exclude this Trump phenomenon, but to be overtly racist, right, versus it was during the antebellum South, to create that difference between blacks and whites in America and to give legal ground into controlling black bodies. Now, that's a little bit less acceptable, especially when you look at the justice system, and it tries to present itself as a source that, you know, is equality for all. We know for a fact that it's not, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think it's really interesting when people say, well, they're just police officers, they're just doing their jobs. Well, their jobs derive from, you know, slave
control.
Hunters and controlling black bodies. And so that's a very important piece that we can't, you know, overlook within our society today, because we see kind of the phenomenon, the effect of the overt racism being played out today with police officers and racial profiling and police brutality.
And you call it the Trump phenomenon. It raises this question to me: which came first, the chicken or the egg, this overt racism or the Trump phenomenon?
I think that from a sociological perspective, Donald Trump is a product of America. It's a product of the historical and foundational systemic social inequalities that are embedded within our justice system. They're embedded in our Constitution. They're embedded throughout the jurisprudence within our society. And there's no way we can really escape that unless we really do a lot of work in rewriting constitutions, rewriting policies, coming up with a list of demands that we need the federal government to address to reduce police brutality. There's no reason why a police officer who's carrying around a gun should be afraid of black and brown bodies, right? If you're afraid of black and brown bodies, perhaps you shouldn't be in a field that you have lethal force to, you know, kill someone. And so there's a lot of different things, I think, that can be done. However, we can't divorce the fact that, you know, policing as we know today derived from slave hunters. That's something that will not ever change. And we can't, you know, we can't change history. So Donald Trump is kind of the product of all of these moving pieces together, of racism and institutionalization of racism, really, that we've seen throughout our history of America.
And to your point, it would take an awful lot of work and work on more than just the part of black Americans. There has to be an awakening in white America and an understanding that we need whole-scale changes in the justice system and in so many of the social institutions that we just accept as they are currently. But this is no longer going to work.
Correct. I think that another piece of that is learning the history, right? Like, when we think about the police brutality that really erupted, you know, during the times of lynching, during the Civil Rights Movement, during the Black Power Movement, right? There was the Deacons for Defense decided to police the police, right, to try to diminish police brutality. Then you move to the 80s, there was this war on drug, where there was an infiltration of the federal government using police aid to over-police, right, black and brown areas. And then in the past 20 years, there's been the militarization of the police, right? So it's almost getting worse in the sense
Absolutely.
That there's more legitimation into police officers having discretion. There's war tactics being used, and there's, you know, inhumane tactics being used, according to the United Nations, that are being used within the United States against marginalized populations such as Native Americans, such as Latino populations, as well as Black populations. So in order for us to move forward, we do have to learn this history and to be aware of what's going on, what has happened before, so we don't repeat the same mistakes.
It is stunning, the disregard for Black bodies that we are seeing today. And I believe that it is more than just we're capturing it on video. What are your thoughts?
We've seen, video, police officers wearing body cams is not going to solve it, a thing, right? Mm-hmm. A prime example of that would be Rodney King, right? There was literally, you know, video of him being beaten, right? And the officers were still acquitted. Video cameras are not the silver bullet. Mm-hmm. I don't think there is a silver bullet. I do think that limiting police officers' discretion could help. More cultural training. We need to have police officers who, obtain college degrees, and so they can take sociological classes, they can take cultural competency classes, they can take history classes, right? Just to have a broader worldview and a world perspective on people who are different than them. Mm-hmm. I think that can go across the board with learning different cultures, whether it's Native culture or Latino culture or Black cultures, which are often not valued or often different than those who are in power. But having that cultural competency is very important, right? Mm-hmm. So there's lots of different things that can be done on state and federal levels that are not done. And to kind of go off on that a little bit, we look at similar nations such as, like, for England, for an example. Mm-hmm. Their police officers don't carry guns, right? And so we have to look at other nations who are comparable to the United States and see what strategies they're using to police crime. Because right now we have an over-policing of Black and brown bodies and under-policing of issues that are really pertinent to our society that deal with social problems, right, mm-hmm. on a daily basis within neighborhoods. So we kind of have to find a cure for that over-policing, under-policing, and find a way for just policing to happen because they're there to protect and serve, correct?
They are.
And right now, they're not protecting and serving Black and brown and Native communities at all.
That's so very true. You know, to even broach the idea of police without guns would strike at the heart of the whole gun control issue in America, which is a different battle, which I also feel is tied to race and racism in America.
Yes. Yes, exactly. There's plenty of articles out there from different historians, different sociologists who discuss the link the Second Amendment, your Second Amendment right mm-hmm. to bear arms with racism, right? Mm-hmm. This idea of protecting and serving was really only derived during enslavement because it was really only to protect and serve property-owning white men, right? And so property was whether they owned plantation and owned individuals, they owned people. That's why that property piece is so important because it was to protect and preserve the property rights. Because during that time, property rights were utilized as civil rights and you could vote and things like that. And so we really have to look at the foundation of these policies and these amendments and which they derive from, right? And
right.
so there always is going to be a racial aspect to be able to protect your own land, right? That's the idea, that to protect your land and your own property. And so there's always a racial aspect underlining, or whether it's more covert or more overt, It's there. It's always there. And that's kind of a large pill for many people to swallow.
It is.
They want, you know, this colorblind agenda oftentimes. But we really have to look at the legislation that's being passed, who it's affecting the most, who are the decision makers in that, and where are going to be the outcomes for most of us, right? And oftentimes when you're a part of a community that is marginalized, whether you're Black, Latino, or Native, the consequences are probably not going to benefit you the most. And so this is why we need a list of demands, so to speak, for federal change and policymaking, as well as policymaking in regards to guns, in regards to policing, mm-hmm. racial profiling, brutality. I mean, the list really could go on.
And it takes us right back to your point that in order for us to see changes, we need to have, there's a lot of work involved. But it's hard to get that work done when more than half of the population simply is not comfortable having a discussion about the primary underlying issue, and that is race.
Yep.
That's
yep.
the starting
it all
point.
It all goes back to race. Mm-hmm. Race and racism are always sensitive topics for quite a few Americans.
Mm-hmm. Sociologist Veronica Newton joining us for the Village Celebration. Thank you so much for your thoughts. We always appreciate them. And we'll be back in a moment.